Mary, thank you for agreeing to talk to me. The first question that I wanted to ask you was about fossil fuel subsidies, something which you've picked up on as a problem in the global energy system. Can you tell us a bit about why you think they are such a problem?
Well, I've recognised for quite some time that fossil fuel subsidies are a problem because you're subsidising the very energy source we want to move away from, for obvious reasons. What I hadn't fully appreciated was the scale of the subsidies. The figures ODI refer to are that fossil fuel producers subsidies to fossil fuel producers totaled $523 billion in 2011, and that figure has not gone down. That's really shocking. I know that there is an argument of trying to get to poor people, but again, the figures don't bear out. And it's rich people who largely receive these subsidies. They distort the market. And I think we have to start talking in terms of what we're really doing. It's like subsidies for asbestos. Now, in the past, our parents or grandparents at a certain stage did not know asbestos was harmful. But we know that asbestos is harmful, and we would be shocked if there were subsidies for putting it into buildings or putting it near people because of the effects. We have to think like that about subsidies for fossil fuel, because we have to move away from fossil fuel, and we have to keep the majority of the known reserves of fossil fuel in the ground. And if we keep subsidising a bad way of providing energy, then we won't be moving properly to where we need to be.
So if we need to move to a different energy system, one of the things we know about fossil fuel subsidies is that some of them go to big energy companies to help them look for new energy, but some of them actually hold down prices for consumers. So it may be a tricky problem to try and make this transfer. Have you any idea how we can go about starting to think about that?
Well, part of the subsidy is for kerosene for poor families. Kerosene is not a cheap fuel, and it's a dangerous and nasty one. So those who have to depend on kerosene and candles for light in their home are dependent on fuels that are not safe, that cause fires and terrible burns. And there are cheaper, cleaner energy sources available now. Solar has become a lot more cheaper. There are ways in which we can address the issue of poverty and energy. Poor people do need energy and they need resources, and I want access to renewable energy for the poorest. It's a priority of my foundation. But let's make it safe energy that actually is cheaper in the long run. And it's a false economy, a false way of trying to support those in poverty.
And we've talked a bit about fossil fuel subsidies, something that's been on the agenda here in Warsaw, perhaps more than people expected. You have an entire organisation dedicated to what you call climate justice. Can you tell us a bit about how this does fit into wider questions about climate justice and a bit about what climate justice looks like?
Climate justice starts with the injustice of how the carbon emissions are causing climate shocks that are already affecting the poorest countries and communities who are the least responsible because they don't use fossil fuel. They don't drive cars, they don't have centrally heated buildings, they don't, etc. So there's a huge injustice, but there's also the need to address the opportunity side. What a difference it will make when we do have access to energy that is clean in the homes of those who, the more than 1.23 billion who don't have access to electricity, but even more shocking, the 2.7 billion that still cook on open fires and ingest fumes from coal and wood and animal dung, and have over 4 million deaths a year, according to a recent report of Lancet. So there's a huge health dimension as well. And we are very keen to see transformational leadership. And that means changes of behaviour in a grand scale. And one of the biggest changes of behaviour is to give the incentives to industry to do the right thing, and therefore to put emphasis on the equitable access to a sustainable development, as Lord Nick Stern would call it, to energy for the poorest, but also to jobs and green growth, and indeed a just transition into that.
Okay, and just thinking a little bit more specifically about the politics of this week's conference, you know, we know that we need progress on climate issues, we need justice on climate issues, we need transformation on climate issues, as you just mentioned. But then we've got countries like Japan and Australia taking what you could consider regressive steps in that way. How can we start to deal with problems, political problems like that, if countries are taking these decisions at a time like this?
It is very shocking to me that countries are looking at very short horizons for the steps they're taking. It's very regrettable that Australia has decided to remove the carbon tax, and I'm glad that young Australians and not so young Australians came out in their tens of thousands to protest, because Australia's had, as I understand it, the warmest year in the last year in a continent that is suffering from very real problems of heating that, you know, will be very hard to endure for a lot of families in Australia. And it is understandable that Japan has had huge problems, but again, it's the short-sightedness. And I hope that those business leaders who are looking at longer-term planning in their own business cycle will put more influence on their political leaders, notably in Australia and in Japan and in Canada, and say, you know, you have to look to the long term. You're sitting on stranded assets. The risks. We want to move, and give us the signals, and we can move faster than you would believe in the right direction for a low carbon future that is much better for jobs, for green growth, for families in the future.
It's fair to say that there isn't too much optimism around this week about the outcome of what can be achieved at this conference. What would you see as a successful outcome from this negotiation?
I don't think too many people came to Warsaw with high expectations. This is a little bit of a process conference, and yet it's very important because we only have a limited time, that it moves the agenda sufficiently. So my hope is that it will move the agenda. I would have liked to have seen a lot more commitment on finance than we've seen so far. I do believe very firmly that we mustn't divide in our world on the issue of the costs to communities. The fact that in Doha, and it did surprise quite a number of people, there was a decision to address loss and damage and to ask for some institutional arrangement is a recognition that for many, not many yet, but for significant communities, we've gone beyond adaptation. For some people in the Philippines, a country very used to adapting, who went into their shelters, who did all the things they were supposed to do and had everything wiped away, what are they to say? It's beyond adaptation already. It's loss and damage. And for the islands that are seeing the sea rise gradually erode and will force them to move, you know, it's beyond adaptation. So we have to see a continuum of mitigation, adaptation, loss and damage. But I believe we have to do it in a way that brings out human solidarity. You know, I wish we could look at this problem as if, which is the case, the world faces together a huge problem, like we face calamities when they arrive. This is a calamity coming towards us, and it doesn't call for the kind of trade dispute approach that too often predominates here. So I hope that there will be a sufficient recognition that we have to deal with this issue, and that we will increasingly, and the less we mitigate, the more we'll have terrible, appalling problems of loss and damage. If we can mitigate sufficiently, we will lessen that problem. And that's how we should see it. And that's how we should see the balance. And we should have a solidarity, maybe regional and global solidarity funds. I'm less interested in, you know, issues of blame and legal liability and compensation. Maybe we should go the solidarity route, as long as there is funding for loss and damage. So I think we have a lot of conversation to have. And I do hope also that on the nuts and bolts going forward, with a realization that the first half of 2014 has to be a time of increasing by the week the ambition and the leadership, so that we get to the summit in September with political leaders, business leaders, civil society in a different place than January, really committed to saying, you know, we're in this together, we have to do more than we ever thought we were going to have to do, transformational leadership, and yes, we can stay below 2 degrees and hopefully very close to 1.5 degrees in order to be human beings together, sharing our ecosystem. That's what we should have in the front of our mind.
Okay, and just lastly, you've talked in some senses about the stakes at a conference like the COP in Warsaw this week, but sometimes it doesn't feel, although the stakes are so high. You've a great deal of experience of the reality of political negotiations. Do you perhaps have some idea of what perhaps the best advice negotiators could receive, or even the worst advice negotiators could receive this week?
I think the problem for the negotiators is that they're in a sort of negotiating bubble, and they don't get enough political leadership from the very top in their own countries. And that's actually what we have to address. It is the prime ministers and the finance ministers and those who have responsibility for their overall leadership who need to pay attention and get very engaged in this. And that is, I hope, what will happen in the first few months of 2014 leading up to that summit.